Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chair of today's event, and the Humanities Forum organizes it. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's topic in our series is slightly different than some of our others, but it's a more practical idea about ideas. What really do ideas do in life? We talk about the idea, we talk about somebody's ideas. How influential are they? And this is an example of one of the ideas that I have about you know, human civilizations, different cultures. And that is that there is no real new sets of personalities or ideas going on anywhere, but the market share of different ideas increases or decreases at different times. And so if there's a society, for example, if there's a society where everyone thinks you should cheat on your taxes, you know, you have Italy. And, you know, it's like 60% of the people cheat on their taxes. It has a huge influence on what happens. And if it's 5%, everybody can kind of deal with it. So you have the idea that you should cheat on their taxes. That's an idea in culture. What market share of the people believe in that idea? And what I find interesting about that whole thing, you know, how many people are practical, how many people are irrational, how many people, you know, are optimists, how many are pessimists, those kind of things really influence the overall effect of the culture and the overall influence of the culture. And in this case, we have Silicon Valley, our local environment, in which a great deal of innovation has taken place by large numbers of institutions, not just one or two, but large numbers of institutions, large numbers of creative individuals have had this impact. And a lot of people have studied why is it that San Francisco has done this. Of course, the fact that Stanford and Berkeley are here is one reason people mention, but a lot of different reasons are mentioned. And so each of the speakers has a different background, a different approach to which those ideas are. But I thought it'd be fascinating because there is a difference in the general character, even though we're all human and we all have the same sort of spread as everybody else. But there is a flavor to Silicon Valley and the Bay Area's culture, which, of course, is one of the reasons we all live here. So that's what we're going to speak about today. Let me introduce to you our three panelists. Dan Cooperman is a professor at Stanford Law School and of counsel at Bingham McCutcheon, where he used to be.
Lecture.
Okay.
They'd be very offended by that, by that mistake. So let's clear it up for the record.
All right, for the record, lecturer, not professor. Bingham McCutcheon is the firm when it was McCutcheon Doyle that Dan you started at, right? Mm-hmm. And Dan was general counsel at Oracle for many years and also at Apple Computer. So he's been in the middle of this revolution. Next is Mark Tuttle, who was invested in a lot of properties, companies here in Silicon Valley, and has been an entrepreneur for many years. And Professor Fred Tuttle, is that, do I have that right, or
Turner.
Associate Professor?
Turner.
Professor Turner, sorry.
Thank you.
Fred Turner. Mm-hmm. And Fred is the Associate Professor of Communication at Stanford. He's the author of From Counterculture to Cyberculture, Stuart Brand, The Whole Earth Network, and the Rise of Digital Utopianism. So I'm sure you can see what Fred's background is on investigating what's going on in the Bay Area. So, without further ado, Dan, we'll make presentations from each of the presenters, and then we'll open up to questions fairly early. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, thanks very much, George. So what I'd like to do is just share with you some of my impressions about a topic that I really am asked a lot about. What is it about Silicon Valley that's so special? And what does it take to foster that same climate that promotes entrepreneurship and innovation in other parts of the world? And, you know, it's very interesting because today, I think, was the first day in probably, 4 years, I forgot my smartphone, my iPhone, of course. And it was interesting because 4 years ago, of course, is when the iPhone appeared. And today, I mean, I was lost. Totally lost without it, because so much of your life now is on a device that didn't even exist. And I think what could better illustrate this innovation, than a total disruption in your own life and your own habits and so forth as you go about the day for something that is a brand new invention. So as people, as I travel around the country and around the world, people are eager to create Silicon Valleys in their own locale. So they're asking for what is that secret formula? So in reflecting on this, what I'd like to do is to share with you this evening a few ideas about what is so special about Silicon Valley and what really has created, what are the kind of the laboratory conditions that have fostered this environment of tremendous spirited innovation and entrepreneurship. So we start with something I think that George has already mentioned, and that is the fact that we are blessed by being in a community that is the home for several major important universities. Obviously Stanford, UC Berkeley, UCSF, and some of the other Cal schools like San Jose State University, very important components in what it takes to make Silicon Valley so great. You've got quite a few people who are attracted by the scholarship here, by the academics, as well as people who've pursued advanced degrees in math, engineering, and the sciences. And it makes for a very rich base of talent that populates our community, and that's, of course, very important. But beyond that, universities have played a very important role in innovation themselves. Let's think about it. Companies like Sun, like Yahoo, like Genentech, Google, all born in the universities. They were born in the universities. And the universities here are very comfortable with the concept of spending their dollars, their academic funding, on basic research, but then focusing the practical aspects of that research on commercializing it using the help of corporate sponsors. And this notion of corporate sponsorship of academic research has really become very well developed. It's a model that is now exploited actually everywhere around the country. But Stanford and Berkeley were one of the first universities to really take this opportunity, this paradigm, and create significant wealth to the university and retain shares in the companies that they've promoted. So there's a well-developed culture within the university on focusing on the practical aspects of the basic R&D that the university fosters. And, you know, it's even interesting. I, as George mentioned, I teach now a course, just one course, that's why I'm a lecturer, at Stanford Law School. And when I was the general counsel at Oracle and at Apple, I funded at the law school a project called the Intellectual Property Litigation Clearinghouse. And it was an idea that some of the IP faculty had at Stanford about creating a database, a very rich and accessible, searchable database that would contain not only the decisions in IP cases all around the company, a country, but all of the pleadings and information about who the lawyers were, who the judges were, what the motions were that were filed in these cases, and what the results of those motions were. So it was a very rich database that was being put together. And in fact, that database was created. This so-called clearinghouse came into being, and it really took off. People wanted access to it. So the law school began granting licenses to access this database, and as you might expect, the interest became so great that it became quite an important sideline for the law school. So the law school did a spin-out. And they spun out this this litigation clearinghouse to a corporation. It's now called Lex Machina, Inc. And this is a for-profit corporation that is a spin-out of all places from the law school. But it illustrates, I think, very well this whole feeling, this comfortable feeling within the university setting of the university playing, if you will, a spawning ground for corporations. So the first factor is the presence here in our community of great universities. The second one is the existence of a very deep talent pool. And here, I mean, it is absolutely the case in Silicon Valley. We have some of the most talented and highly skilled software engineers, hardware engineers, environmental, clean tech engineers, mathematicians, you know, who do analytics for video games companies, statisticians, biomedical scientists and engineers who combine their engineering and their medical knowledge to develop new medical devices. A lot of that taking place here, robotics, artificial intelligence. I mean, these are real specialties and very well-developed specialties. They all exist in our community, and we have very deep resources in all of these. And the culture among this technically-minded community is very mobile, and there are a lot of meetups, opportunities for meetings, with other entrepreneurs, and with other engineers in different disciplines. So there's this cross-fertilization of ideas coming from people who have the different disciplines, who are sharing ideas, thinking together about how they can themselves develop, take an idea and develop into perhaps a product or a service that doesn't yet exist. It kind of spurs that creativity. And another dimension to it really is that the entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley are heroes. They're heroes. People want to be entrepreneurs. They're not regarded as losers because they're working on their own or they're working in a company that has three people, as you might find in other parts of the country or other parts of the world, where if you're not associated with a very big, well-known name, well, you haven't really succeeded. In Silicon Valley, it's absolutely, you're a hero if you're working for a startup. People want to work for startups, and that's important, too. The entrepreneurs get a tremendous amount of encouragement and support from our community. And, you know, let's not forget, I mean, the Bay Area itself, leaving aside the talent pool and universities, is a very attractive place to live. So that itself attracts a lot of people who are interested in experiencing the beauty and the life here in Silicon Valley. The third factor is what I would say is a very rich infrastructure within the community. The entrepreneurs in our community are supported by a myriad of services, which provide a common foundation to startups in a variety of diverse technology-based industries. Certainly, and well-known, is the venture capital community, which has very deep roots here, and I'll talk about them in just a few minutes. But aside from venture capitalists, who are some of these other providers, service providers, who form this fabric in our infrastructure? Well, I'll start with lawyers. Because I happen to be having a soft spot for them. Lawyers in Silicon Valley are in a very important part of the community. Lawyers focus, many of the lawyers in Silicon Valley practice focus on work for startup companies. And the issues for startups really are quite different and distinguishable from the issues that pertain to large companies. So issues like granting stock options or founder stock questions, how to capitalize a company with all different classes of stock. We have founders and people providing the money and maybe some institutional investors. IP issues, which are extremely important in Silicon Valley. You have a talent pool of individuals who can respond and analyze those issues as well as any place in the country. Lawyers are well schooled to identify what technologies would be, for example, patentable. What does it take to get a patent? Distribution arrangements for products and managing supply chain. So these are all legal issues that lawyers in our community are very well equipped to handle. And lawyers are used to serving in their role as facilitators for entrepreneurs. So they will make introductions of the entrepreneurs and other service providers. They will even take their fees in a rather promotional way. Some take it for stock. Some take warrants. Some will defer fees until the company is commercially successful. So even the lawyers are kind of taking risks that lawyers in other parts of the country simply don't do. But beyond lawyers, our bankers. Our bankers lend on IP collateral. In New York, if you were to talk to a banker about that, they would look at you as if you were from another planet. You know, banks were not used to lending on intellectual property. That whole line of financing was really developed here in Silicon Valley. Accountants who are in our community are experienced in handling startup issues, and there are many accounting issues that pertain to startup companies. Cheap stock issues, in particular, often bedevil many of these companies. And there are accounting issues that could prevent the companies, if not done properly, from going public. So bringing the accountants in to help share their views and their ideas important as well. And they are focused on startup issues. Landlords, believe it or not, landlords in Silicon Valley will often take a portion of their return in warrants or in stock. Who ever heard of this? I mean, this is not a common practice in other parts of the country or certainly other parts of the world. And yet, it's not that unusual in Silicon Valley for a landlord to ask for a warrant as part of the rent. And executive recruiters, of course, are very used to dealing with the skill base that are required to populate the companies with people of the skills that are required. So we have, and those are just a few examples, we have a very deep infrastructure of service providers who can help entrepreneurs really get their legs underneath them. That is a very important quality here in this community that simply doesn't exist in many places. A fourth factor is the culture of the Valley that supports and promotes risk-taking. This is particularly true when you compare Silicon Valley against other countries who aspire to have Silicon Valley types of communities. And this can often be a major stumbling block because in many other cultures, a business failure is often career-ending. It's seen as a blemish, a black mark from which an individual may never recover. In Silicon Valley, on the other hand, there is really no stigma attached to business failure. Indeed, it's often been said to me by venture capitalists that if somebody has filed for bankruptcy or has had a business failure in their past, that they see that as a quality. A strength of the management team of the startup, because you know they know what it means to run out of money, they know what not to do, and with you know equipped with the right combination of skills in their colleagues, that can be an attractive aspect to the venture capitalists. So the Silicon Valley culture is really to revere extraordinary companies and extraordinary performance, not to revere average companies. Companies are not thought of highly simply because they employ a lot of people. The company is thought of highly because it does something cool. It does something interesting and new, innovative. Those are the companies that really have the mojo. In Silicon Valley, and that kind of propels people to come up with ideas that are truly novel and involve taking a significant amount of risk, because they're rewarded with the backing of the community. Again, the culture promotes that kind of risk taking. I'm not going to deal here with some of the downsides that can create, but I just leave you with the impression that that's not all good. Because risk-taking has some downsides. Okay, a fifth factor is something that I think is not as emphasized as I think it needs to be, and that is the cultural diversity and what I'll call the global literacy of the Silicon Valley community. The Bay Area, and we all know this, is one of the most diverse communities in the United States and one of the most diverse communities in the world. There are over 100 languages spoken in Silicon Valley, and actually more than that here in San Francisco. It's a remarkably diverse community, and the people who live here are very tolerant and understanding of one another, appreciating one another for what they are and who they are, and having a willingness to quote an old marketing phrase of my employer, think different. To think different. And that's respected. That's cherished. That's valued. There is no stereotype for who an entrepreneur is or should be. Anyone can be an entrepreneur. It is more than any other community I've ever lived in or have known a meritocracy. People are judged by what have you done, not who are you, what is the color of your skin, or what religion are you, or what have you. And that, I think, is part of the secret sauce that makes Silicon Valley so great. And if you come down to the offices of companies in Santa Clara and San Jose, you will see a rich tapestry of people from all walks of life, from all backgrounds, speaking all different languages, and they're all working together in teams on common projects. A very unifying force. And I think it's been underestimated the impact that that has on the success of the community. The sixth factor is the availability of funding sources. Now, here I said we were going to come back to venture capitalists, and I think we all know that the venture capital community is a very healthy, vibrant community in Sand Hill Road and Menlo Park. But what is often not understood is that the venture capitalists provide a fraction, a small fraction actually, of the funding that's available to entrepreneurs. So where does the money come from? Well, it comes from the sources that you would expect. First of all, it comes from mom and dad. That's kind of the wallet of first resort. Friends and family, that's an important source of funding, but that's true everywhere. But there are a lot of wealthy individuals who also are interested in helping entrepreneurs get going. And they have they provide a good deal of the funding in the early rounds for entrepreneurs and startup companies in Silicon Valley. And then you've probably heard the term angels and angel networks. And there are many, many angel networks that are at work in Silicon Valley, providing not just money, but what angels do is they provide guidance, tutelage, mentorship to the entrepreneurs and the management of these startups. And that is really invaluable. So along with the money comes that type of assistance. So those are important sources for capital, and they are readily available in Silicon Valley. And that, again, is a very important part of the secret of the success in the Valley. The final factor I'll mention, and I don't purport for a moment to think this is an exhaustive list, is the work ethic in Silicon Valley and what I'll call the hero worshiping. The work ethic. These jobs are not 9-to-5 jobs. The people in Silicon Valley are in their work life very intense, despite all appearances of being kind of laid back or casual. The companies are anything but. They are very intense. People work extremely hard. They often work for 24 hours straight and don't even know whether it's day or night. It requires an enormous personal and social sacrifice. Many of these people really don't have much of a family life because they can't. I mean, they're just working too hard, and that's why many of the people who are entrepreneurs are young. I think you run out of energy very quickly if you're going to do that for very long. And part of the work ethic, I think, also is a very strong sense of teamwork and collaboration. And I already mentioned this a little bit before, but it's an important part, again, of this work ethic and what makes the Valley tick. And then finally, hero worship. Well, we treat our heroes in Silicon Valley like the music industry would treat rock stars, or the movie industry would treat the movie stars. People like Larry Ellison or Gordon Moore, certainly Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg, these are all household names, and each has a cult following. These people are revered. And it feeds the stories about what it's like to have those heroes, what it's like to work with them, and how important it is to be like them, to please them, to do to execute their vision. It inspires people. And that inspiration is also a very important part of the formula that makes Silicon Valley successful. So I'll stop there, and those are just a few thoughts, and I'm sure we can come up with some others about why it is such a special place to be.
And one of the side shoots of this cultural phenomenon I saw in New York when I was working there in the 90s, suddenly a group of executives came from Silicon Valley to have a meeting in New York with their major financiers, and they didn't wear suits. Some were wearing jeans, some were and this business casual idea, which you would never have assumed that this was going to beat the New York bankers and the New York lawyers and everything into submission, but it did. It won everywhere. So, Mark.
Okay, so I can streamline my remarks given what Dan has said. So what I challenge you to do as an audience is to say how many places around the world had some or many of those seven things. And so what I'm going to do is talk from a personal point of view about a comparison. This is a book by Anna Lee Saxenian, who compared, you know, why didn't Route 128 outside Boston become Silicon Valley? Why did Silicon Valley become Silicon Valley? So it's like it's a controlled experiment. I work in healthcare, so it's like a retrospective paired analysis. And so what you do is you start taking things off the table that are common to the region surrounding Boston and the Bay Area. So we'll go through these. So, the woman who wrote this is now a dean at Berkeley, and she was from Boston. And they don't like her there, but that's about it. And one reason I want to do this from a personal point of view is that then none of you can really question it because you don't know. All right. So, what do the regions have in common, which is what forces the question? So, number one, big-time research universities. World class. They're kind of equal. Okay? Number two, they both were heavily and centrally involved in science and technology in winning World War II and winning the Cold War. This was huge. A huge amount of your tax money was pumped into both regions to produce technology that won those two conflicts. So again, they're the same on those fronts. However, you know, after that, it starts to get a little dicier. Oh, I got to add one more, and this is going to eat into his shtick here. In the 60s and the early 70s, I was on the East Coast, and my sister was at Berkeley. And the differences were just shades of gray. The countercultural revolution was going on, student riots, the whole nine yards. There really wasn't any cultural difference politically. All right, so now, what's the difference? And Dan started off on this one. The most profound cultural difference between the northeast of the U.S. and Northern California is in regards risk. And I cannot emphasize this enough. So one of my favorite passages from Moby Dick is on the ship when Ishmael is trying to get hired to go on the voyage. And the two captains who own the ship are retired. And the ship is their Social Security payment. It's their 401k. It's everything that they own. So they are very, very tight with handing out the way that they pay the crew, the shares of the net profits. So it's like a startup. A whaling voyage is like a startup in the 19th century. So Ishmael gets a 300th. And Queequeg, the master harpooner, gets a 90th because they really want him. And they're arguing amongst themselves and with Ishmael saying, well, we have all the widows and orphans to support. And this is true because the widows and orphans are the descendants of the original investors in the ship. So you can imagine the risk pressure on this operation. So first of all, we have two retired captains, you know, presumably they're at the top of their profession. This is their nest egg, period. if that ship goes down, if the voyage fails, if something bad happens, it often does, they're in a world of hurt. Same with the widows and orphans. And that's why there's this long dialogue about, well, you know, do we really want you? And why do you want to come on a voyage? You say, well, I want to see the world. And they point to the ocean and say, that's all you're going to see. 4 years, you know, before you come back. So, again, I said this was all going to be personal now. So my father's great uncle Lucius, as a boy, ran away from home to join a whaling ship. And we know when this happened because he was on the ship and then he in the ocean when Krakatoa exploded. He came home 5 years later and died 2 years later, you know, presumably from some disease that he contracted somewhere. Whaling was deeply risky, so on. So again, there's this enormous pressure. And getting back to the failure point, let's suppose you're a captain or a first mate on a ship and the voyage fails. Whether it's your fault or not, you're toast. You're done. You're not going to get another gig unless you go to another continent, you know, or change your name. So the New England view of investment is highly risk-averse and highly intolerant of failure. I cannot emphasize this enough. And you come to California, now it's a whole different ballgame, because why did people come to California? What's the number one thing that brought them here?
Gold.
What's number two? 1865, editorial in the New York Post. Horace Greeley, go west, young man, go west. So the younger siblings of my New England ancestors, you know, the older sons, they all stay home, take the farm, and, you know, run the business, whatever it is, and the younger siblings go west. So you get this gene pool, number one, and who knows if risk-taking is genetic, but it is certainly cultural.
Well, you said you're in the medical field.
So we generate a view, and also the gold rush is one source of the diversity that he's talking about, because people came from all over the world and then somehow for a while got along and seeded the Bay Area with, you know, from every imaginable country. So we've got this... A completely different view of risk because the people who came here wanted to make it big, either financially or in an impact on the world. They want to be a star. So there's a famous short story, The American Dream Ends at the End of the Santa Monica Pier. Now, the Santa Monica Pier is long gone, but that's like the farthest point west. You can keep going west and that's it, you're here. So you've got to make your dream here. That is not true in Boston and New England. That's the gene pool from which I came, but I came here anyway, so you can imagine. All right. So the personal risk is extremely different. So I've been interviewed formally and informally by Harvard professors and by Swiss bankers about this precise question. So the Harvard professors say, Mark, God damn it, you know, what are you guys doing out there? You know, what happened? Why didn't Route 128, which had an enormous high-tech component left over from World War II and the Cold War, why didn't it become Silicon Valley? And my version of the seven reasons, not as sophisticated, but and one of the things that I came up with that they could finally accept, because most of what I'd say is, just, you know, it's not true. It's got to be something else. You know, you cheated or you lied. It's the secrecy thing. So the industrial culture in New England, for historical reasons, was heavily devoted to secrecy. So, for instance, Digital Equipment Corporation, which came to my engineering school at Dartmouth many times to give talks, they made every single component that went into every piece of equipment. They made their own monitors, their own keyboards, their own transistors. I mean, they made everything. They didn't outsource anything. And they took deep personal offense if you went to work for another company. I mean, they tried to have the golden handcuffs, you know, give you stock, treat you nice, but it was very, very inward-looking, and it was not at all the collaborative thing that Dan described. So the Swiss came here and goes, you know, Mark, geez, how are we ever going to get any of this in Switzerland? And I said, well, you know, start with venture capital. Well, we don't have venture capital. I said, well, that's a problem. So I think the Swiss are sort of the extreme version of New England. I can say that because that's my heritage. So. All right. So we've discovered, we talked about risk, secrecy, and again, in Silicon Valley, in contrast to Digital Equipment Corporation, which made everything in-house, in Silicon Valley, everybody took in everybody else's laundry. And an easier way to start a company was to make something which all the other companies needed, however mundane and simple it was. That was a way to bootstrap yourself into existence. And again, there was no, you know, like, well, of course you would do that. Why would you want to reinvent something that somebody else had already invented if you could just buy it? Besides, we're in a hurry. We don't have time, you know, that kind of thing. So there's and then, of course, the revolving door of middle management and software engineers and so on who, one, they're already talking to one another anyway, even though they work for different companies, which would be absolutely verboten in the Northeast. And two, they would all kind of, you know, jump ship when a better job appeared and so on. So there was this kind of this, the gene pool got diverse instead of too focused. So most startups failed, remember, statistically. And so this contributes to Dan's pool of people who have failure and presumably learned something. And the venture capitalists kind of dug, duh, you know, they got onto this one. And if you had failed, they took you more seriously than if you were a wonder boy. That's another interesting point. And, of course, the people from the East Coast were typically the wonder boys, you know, blue blood, Phi Beta Kappa, you know, all this kind of stuff. And less so the kind of the immigrant fringe. So the tolerance of failure was a huge differentiator. All right, so my summary, again, is risk, secrecy, tolerance for failure as differentiators for New England and thing. And so my last thing is, well, where are we going for this? So a few years ago, I went to Korea, and Korea had decided it was too late to compete on information technology. You know, they'd gotten in too late. Okay. What were they going to do? They were going to compete on biotech. Now, interesting, does anybody in the room know how they're doing? Yeah, okay. Well, we don't. So the jury's out. We haven't won yet. And, of course, India is doing extremely well, and China, we don't know yet in terms of trying to redo this.
Great.
I'm done.
Keep talking. Okay. Great.
Great.
All so, right. Go ahead.
I'll just jump right in. I'm Fred Turner, and I'm a cultural historian by training and trade. And I want to pick up on two things that Dan and Mark have talked about as I talk a little bit about sort of where Silicon Valley comes from. And the two words that I want to make sure that I leave you with today are ethos and ecology. Silicon Valley, on the one hand, is an ecology of institutions, individual actors. You know, it has a strong infrastructure, an infrastructure that is both material and cultural. And at the same time, it's permeated with an ethos that, as Mark points out, comes in part from its history simply by virtue of being in Northern California, its gold rush history, its end of the American West, end of the American dream location. All of that is really, really important. Although I do want to note that, you know, my first intellectual affection was the American Puritans. And I want to say they were pretty entrepreneurial. You know, they came over with some hustle. Okay, so ethos and ecology. And I want to focus particularly on ethos, and I want to focus on the idea that ethos, that ideas, literally structure how you do your work together. Okay, we've been talking so far as if the choices about how we work together, the institutional structures, the collaborative structures that we work with in Silicon Valley, are determined by essentially rational self-interest. Or some version of same. And I want to argue that that's not necessarily the case, and that, in fact, they're inherited in a number of cases from a kind of legitimating impulse that came about in the 1960s, and before that, from the military research world in the 1940s. Okay, two myths have to go to make the rest of my talk work. The first myth is that the Cold War, starting at the end of World War II and continuing through the 1950s and into the 1960s, was a closed world of psychological and social containment. That's a myth. I'm going to bust it in a second. The second myth that I want to get out of the way is the myth that the American counterculture was one movement simultaneously political and cultural. One person said to me, yeah, it was great. You know, we protested the war during the day and got high at night. It's a little more complicated than that. I'm going to come back to that. Okay. First, on the closed world point. One of the things that astonished me when I started researching Stuart Brand and the Whole Earth crew, who've been very influential here in the Bay Area, was how much they owed to the 1940s. So I wrote this book, From Counterculture to Cyberculture, and people said, well, it's great. You finally showed how hippies brought us computers. Actually, what I thought I was doing was showing how the military-industrial world of the 1940s brought us hippies. Okay, so the myth about the 40s and 50s that I inherited was that it was a sort of a silo world, very, very rigid, very, very contained, very heterosexual, very normal. Everybody lived in Levittown. Okay, so I go rummaging around, and I find something entirely different. What I find is that in the military-industrial research world that helps drive the rise of Silicon Valley, thanks to Fred Terman and Stanford and some contracts he got, what you actually have is a rigid bureaucracy within which people are enormously flexible and collaborative. World War II brings together disciplines in research worlds for the very first time. Biologists, engineers, scientists, accountants all start hanging out together. Okay, my favorite book in all the research I've ever done, this is, if there's a grad student in the room, I bless you with this, is the memoirs of the wives of the radiation laboratory at MIT, who were there during World War II, describing what it was like to be in a family, a radiation laboratory family, during that era. The radiation laboratory is a place where Norbert Wiener worked, a whole slew of people who were very important in military research worked. And what they described was a proto-communal world, a world where work never stops, where housing is short, people live together in multifamily units, people get together at the bar at night and continue the work they were doing in the lab during the day. This kind of blurring of the social and the professional, this interdisciplinary interaction, funded from outside and driven by a higher purpose, in this case winning World War II, but here in the Valley by other purposes, that's the thing. That's the thing that in many ways gets picked up by the American counterculture of the 1960s. So how is it that a counterculture that protests the Vietnam War, that says, you know, everyone over 30 is wrong, should owe a debt to the 1940s? Okay, to get there, we have to acknowledge that there were, in fact, two countercultures, and we tend not to think this way. During my early interviews, I interviewed Todd Gitlin, who was one of the founders of the Students for Democratic Society. And he said, oh, you're working on Stuart Brand? I hate him. Okay, I interviewed Stuart Brand, and I said, you know, so I spoke with Todd Gitlin. He said, oh, I hate him. And what was intriguing about this was that there was clearly a tension between a kind of political wing, a kind of, you know, think of it as the new left wing, a group doing politics to change politics, and another wing, a countercultural wing, a new communalist wing, which turned away from politics. Ken Kesey, famously invited to lead a protest here in Oakland, declined. He got up, head of the anti-war protest, they're going to march to the Oakland Armory. He gets up, he pulls out his harmonica, plays Home on the Range, and says, don't march. That's what they do. What we do is go home and build a new kind of world. Okay, go home and build a new world. In a nutshell, that's the Silicon Valley ethos. For the new communalist wing of the counterculture, small-scale technologies were to be the key to building new kinds of community, new kinds of personality that would be alternatives to the rigid hierarchical world that they imagined American government and American society to be in the 1960s. So the thing about the new communalists is that they were located all around here. The Merry Pranksters got together at Stanford. Ken Kesey and many of the other pranksters in the early years were Wallace Stegner fellows in the writing program. I love to tell my students this, and then I get really depressed when they say, who are the pranksters? Yeah. It's a sad thing. But my point is that Stanford in the 1960s, as it was developing a series of technologies, was also permeated by countercultural actors who are very, very busy. Meantime, the things that the counterculture makes, like the Whole Earth Catalog, became literal models for activity in Silicon Valley. So this is the Whole Earth Catalog. Stuart Brand started it in 1968. This is the 1972 version. I will pass this around. Don't worry. It'll crumble in your hands. It's fine. I got others. Two things I want to say about it. First, most of its contents were books. And when Xerox PARC was first built in Palo Alto, Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, the librarian who came from New York wanted to know what to put in the library. And Alan Kay, who went on to have an important role in designing the laptop, took her to the Whole Earth Catalog store, and they bought every book that appeared in the catalog. And that was the Xerox PARC library for the first couple of years. Okay. Second story is another Alan Kay story. Alan Kay is working on interfaces that are going to become the Dynabook. It's part of his, it ultimately leads to the laptop. One of his ideas for interface designs comes very specifically from that book. And it's an idea about how to thread information across screens. And it's a technique that's used in the Whole Earth Catalog. What I want to say is that the countercultural habit of trying to make new communities through technology, of trusting business and not politics, of seeking a shared community based on shared mindset and shared consciousness, led to the creation of specific information forms and specific ways of working together that have had a profound impact on Silicon Valley. Tell one more contemporary story. How many of you have been to Burning Man? Yay! Well, there's two of us here tonight. So Burning Man, it's a countercultural festival. It occurs out in the desert every year. It's gone on for 25 years. Its 25th anniversary was this summer. It lasts a week in incredible heat in Nevada. This year, about 40,000 people went out. It's an astonishing affair. At the end of the week, a large, you know, 5 or 6 story wooden man figure is burned. Temples are burned. I've been out a few times. I've written about it extensively. Burning Man is to contemporary digital production what the churches of New England were to industrial production many years ago. Let me tell this short, and I can tell it long if you want to ask more in questions. In industrial New England, you go to church, the owners of the factory sit up front, they have special dedicated boxes, they're the family boxes, and the workers sit in back, and the church itself worships a Protestant God who, by virtue of predestination, at least in the Puritan vision, thinks that if he loves you, he's going to bless you with wealth on this earth. And the church is literally a map of the blessings of God laid upon the New England town. God blesses those in the front more, the owners of the factory. God doesn't like the workers so much. Many of them come from other countries anyways. So that's that. Burning Man. Burning Man is arguably one of the most important semi-religious rituals in Silicon Valley. Google shut down in 1999 to go there. Burning Man, Eric Schmidt, Google CEO, hired in part because he went to Burning Man. It was a credibility point for him. Okay. What on earth would a desert have to do with Google and new media production? Well, on the desert, people work together to make high-tech art. They collaborate intensely. They're super visible to one another. They work in collaborative project teams, subsidized by money from outside, in ways that are hyper-visible to one another. And they celebrate being totally absorbed in their work and simultaneously producing the following things: technological artifacts, new modes of community, and new experiences of self. Okay, so cut to Google. And I can tell this longer. I've told it in deeply academic settings. In Google, how does engineering work? Well, Google engineering works on 20% time. 20% time, one-fifth of an engineer's time at Google is said to be their own. Ironically, in 2006, they did a survey. More than 50% of the products that were developed in the following half of preceding half of 2005 were developed during 20% time. Time when engineers were pursuing self-motivation, self-development, in an environment that at Google is specifically constructed to facilitate interpersonal visibility. Offices are kept small and jammed. They're designed to keep workers there at night, drinking coffee, hanging out. No, I'm not going to say that. You can ask about it. Late night Google is where the action is. Late night Google is an open commons for the collaborative production of information goods organized around personality, around recognizing who's cool and who's not, who's capable and who's not, organized in terms set by bohemian social architecture. And that's where I'll stop. Thanks.
Well, that worked perfectly. I said for each of them to give about 5 or 10 minutes. And I knew that there would be not as much time for comments, but that would work perfectly because there was so much background of three very different approaches to this topic. So who would like to ask the first question?
Thank you. Is Silicon Valley going to be duplicated in other parts of the world?
That's the question. They're certainly trying. I think India's made some progress. Korea, I don't know. China's trying hard, but of course they have huge cultural challenges to overcome. Cambridge, England has made a lot of progress in biotech and computer science. I don't know. What am I missing, Dan? There aren't that many. London is, is clearly international and now the financial center of the world, but not necessarily the technology center. So, you know, I don't know. Japan tried. The fifth generation effort was a specific attempt. And as far as I know, that didn't go anywhere. Many have tried.
I'd like to add just a related question, which is, can Silicon Valley make Silicon Valley going forward? I think that's also important.
Sure.
As technology changes, can we continue to develop and change the ecology of the valley with it in such a way that it sustains movement into new technologies going forward? One other thing about other Silicon Valleys, other Silicon Valleys don't need to look like us. They just need to be a rich ecology for producing their thing. And I think if we shift that a little bit and don't ask it to look quite as much like, you know, the valley here, we might see other very hot regions of growth and development.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. But I've got to say, this issue of Silicon Valley reinventing itself periodically is a phenomenon now that I almost accept without questioning it, because it's happened so many times. People were asking in the mid-90s whether Silicon Valley could continue or whether it was dead. And look at how many generations of technology have come since then. It's really a remarkable. To me, the reason is these foundational factors that we've talked about for the last hour. It's a very special place. And those conditions that foster this entrepreneurial spirit and so forth, it's very hard to duplicate them in other parts of the world.
So Dr. Sakanian says that other places would have to change their culture.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And that's extremely difficult. And that's why New England is not Silicon Valley. That's why New York is not Silicon Valley. Why Philadelphia, New Jersey.
One of the interesting things about the whole panel is that nobody talked about that the base was a particular technology or a particular something that had been invented. It is a set of personalities that approach it. And that, of course, goes to what Dan said, that it probably will just keep reinventing itself, and it might go in a totally different direction, but be successful anyway, because it's based on personality and not on whatever the technology was at the time. Mm-hmm. Next question.
What threats do you see to this structure and this ecology and this culture?
Well, let me start with one, which I think is something we need to be really quite careful about. And that's government regulation. You know, one thing we haven't talked about is how Silicon Valley has developed almost outside the view of Washington. It's an amazing thing. I was the general counsel of Oracle at the time that the Microsoft case was brought by the Department of Justice. And it was the first time that technology executives from Silicon Valley went to Washington to meet their elected representatives. Have a conversation. You know, it just didn't happen. The idea was, look, please leave us alone, and we will leave you alone. And that was the philosophy that the Valley had. The further away the government could stay, the more we would thrive. And to a large extent, certainly the mindset has continued. But the government has not been a catalyst for growth in Silicon Valley. I would say quite the contrary, and that's something I would be worried about.
May I interject and say, at least from a historical perspective, that's not correct. Mm-hmm. The Internet was a government-funded, Defense Department-funded, ARPANET project. Stanford University, an enormous amount of our funding comes from government grants. The NSF, I see more NSF officers on my hallway than I see secretaries. Okay. My point is that government money, Silicon Valley, the chip, the microchip, until 1972, as far as I know, every microchip went into Polaris missiles. Those are paid for by the state. My point is that we have we talk about government as if its primary role in innovation were regulation, constraining innovation, and I want to push very hard back on that and say that on the contrary, one of its most important roles is funding the settings in which innovation can take place, including universities.
Right. Yeah. The question was, what is one of the biggest threats? And I feel one of the biggest threats is government regulation. I'm not talking about government funding, government regulation, which can be helpful, and in many cases it has been constructive, but it could also be deadly, because this culture that exists in Silicon Valley is one that Washington really does not understand.
Well, I agree that Washington doesn't understand it, Dan. Silicon Valley could not exist without the U.S. government, period. Mm-hmm. Could not.
No question.
So here I am a child of the welfare state.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
The GI Bill financed, my dad got a PhD with three kids after World War II. In seventh grade, private school, science and the family. Then what happened? Sputnik. Next year, math, physics, right. Chemistry, biology, taught by university professors who came in to fix it. Because the sociologists had taken over education, and in my opinion, of course, I wanted to be an engineer, they had ruined it. So an enormous amount of money, government money paid for my Ivy League education. Huge subsidy. So then, and everybody that I worked with had been subsidized by the government. Because, and in my view, is that biotech is the last big thing to come out of the pipeline from the enormous amount of money that got pumped into science, right. Technology, and education, starting with Sputnik. And, another whole show here is where we should go and should we do it on energy and so on. But, I think that's the end of the pipeline. So I think it's hypocritical, Dan, to separate the success of Silicon Valley from the enormous investment of the taxpayers in education and infrastructure, the Internet being the primary example, and the Internet is a primary result of Sputnik and so on and so on. Anyway.
Well, I think, Dan, I don't think Dan's point was quite that strong. and let me use an example. What Dan said about, stay away from us. I was in the Soviet Union for the summer in 1973 at the height of Brezhnev's dull civilization. And, once you left Leningrad and Moscow and went to Kiev and Yerevan and Armenia and everything, you saw that the further away you got from Moscow and Leningrad, the more people were breaking the rules and trying to succeed by breaking the rules. And so there's both. Obviously, our government has never been as effective at sitting on everybody as the Soviet Union's government was, but both the money and the rebellion against the money, or rebellion against, maybe like with your parents, you want their money, but you don't want them to tell you what you do with it, right? Mm-hmm. So, next question. The other person went burning man.
Thank you. First off, as an immigrant, a legal immigrant, an H-1B worker, I would agree that government regulation does pose a threat, because we had numerous examples of people who were forced to leave Silicon Valley and fund startups in New Delhi because they didn't get visas to work here. Anyway, my question was...
That's an illustration of how the government simply doesn't get it. What makes Silicon Valley tick.
Mm-hmm. My question was...
We should be stapling a visa to every graduate school diploma that we get.
I've been waiting for 5 years to get my green card.
Yeah, me too. That's a good idea.
Anyway, my question was that how come that given today's video conferencing and telepresence facilities, we don't see more startups popping up, let's say, in the cyberspace among people distributed geographically? Why is it so important to be in close proximity and have face-to-face communication in Silicon Valley, if that is really important?
Well, I think we take Dan's 7 points, and they don't easily translate into the cyber world yet. Now, that could change. It's an important question, because we do see people working in communities that are geographically distributed. And that's a different thing. And so I guess the question is, how many of Dan's 7 things will move into the cyber world, where people don't see each other face-to-face, and they don't have all this support system?
I think one thing that's going to drive this, too, is the ecological idea that you shouldn't use up so much carbon when you're flying all over the world. But on the other hand, all the deals and negotiations that I did as an attorney, I think the ones that were tried to be done without any real meetings always took much longer. And so it was much, much more difficult. And I think you could cut down the number of meetings. On the other hand, I've been in deals where everyone sat around the table for 2 weeks because the general counsel didn't know that they were running up the bill. But other than that, I mean, you really do need a mixture of those things. You need a mixture of seeing the people, knowing who you're working with, and checking their personality and trusting them. There's a little bit of less left of personal trust in the world, and it really needs to be done on the big deals. I'm sure Dan has a lot of stories about that. Next question.
I guess I'm just wondering as to, you know, we hear so much about outsourcing, and lately we have heard how outsourcing may have a negative impact to innovations of this country. So I just wanted to see if you can comment on it.
I can give some more personal examples. There was a time in the recent past, if you were trying to raise money, the venture capitalists wanted you to have your programmers in India. And I think that's still an opportunity, but the imperative has disappeared. And this is sort of venture capital micromanagement as opposed to governmental micromanagement. So I think outsourcing is an opportunity, and it's not an imperative, and I think it's more put in perspective now. And I don't know of any startup. I don't know of any startup where the core software is developed offshore. At least it's an American Silicon Valley startup. There might be some.
Okay, we have time for one or two more questions. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering, do you think brain drain out of Silicon Valley, you know, Indians trying to go back to India to start families, could replicate the culture that they found in Silicon Valley so attractive in India and other places?
I know they're sure trying hard.
Yeah. Annalise Saxenian, author of this book, actually has a second book on this point precisely called The New Argonauts. Mm-hmm. And her argument is that yes, within constraints set by the cultures to which people return. But one of the neatest things about Silicon Valley is that it's not a place, again, like it's unlike New England in this respect, where families come, settle, and stay generation after generation. It's much more like a kind of cosmopolitan flow-through space, like London in, say, the 18th century. And as people flow through and spend 10 years here, 15 years here, and then do go back, absolutely they'll export the culture. One of the reasons I'm so interested in Silicon Valley as a cultural site is that I think we're developing a cultural style that we are exporting dramatically and rapidly around the United States and the world.
So it's different than our movies and our music.
Yeah, very. Mm-hmm. It's our Facebook.
One of the things that started the Renaissance, or at least gave it a big kick, was that there was a professorial conference in Florence, paid for by the Medicis, right in the year when the Ottoman Turks took over Constantinople. And all those professors were left without work, and they couldn't go back to their jobs, and they all got hired to be professors in Florence. By the Medicis, and that had a big impact on the next generation. So part of the influx of the Greek ideas, the ancient Greek ideas and everything, came back that way. So if you're a professor and you're at a conference, it may not be the worst thing in the world if you get cut off from your home. Okay, one last question. Anybody have one more question for our panel? Okay,
My question has more to do, you mentioned risk-taking is one of the keys, but I wonder if optimism and potentially unjustified optimism is driven by a combination of climate and culture. This is an area where it's nice to wake up every day. In North Dakota, it is not nice to wake up every day. And I wonder if that is one of the things that changes the way people on the West Coast view life and the world.
I think that's correct. And I think I'm sure most of you have heard the story about how Native American cultures geographically mimic the current cultures. So, you know, the Indians out here were hippies, kind of, you know, they didn't have wars. And, you know, there were a lot of food and, you know, just kind of the living was easy. And in New England, there was constant battles and alliances and counter-alliances and warfare and so on. And, you know, maybe it was the bad weather.
My inner contrarian wants to remind you of Holland in the 17th century, home of the tulip. Optimism. Holland was one of the most optimistic places in the world for several centuries and one of the most effective. By the same token, Hawaii has never been known for its technological innovation.
So, I lived in Holland for a summer and the sun almost never shone. So my view of Holland is the tulip thing. Tulips had saturated colors, and there was zero. If you look at any painting, it's all brown and gray. And so the tulips provided saturated colors, which evolution. Anyway, never mind.
when Gibbon was talking about the fall and decline of Rome and everything, he was always complaining about the barbarians, you know, from the north coming down, but maybe they were just looking for more sunshine.
No. Yeah.
So, anyway, that's it for tonight. Mm-hmm. This ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 108th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.
So,